President Trump holds a big rally in Jacksonville, just as the Jaguars play at home. Early voting begins in Florida before we know it, and the first ballots are already going out. And parents demand more transparency about COVID in schools. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Give us a call. Already getting your calls. The number to join us, 549-2937. Then later, it's Echoes of the Gilded Age in new artwork at the Leitner Museum. We'll take a closer look, but first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy week in the news, we welcome Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics is on the line. Hi, A.G.
Hi, Melissa.
Our regular contributor and board member, Charles Griggs. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning, Melissa.
And rounding out our panel, Sky LeBron of our own WJCT News. Hi, Sky.
Hey, Melissa.
And we'll go to your calls in a moment about the week that was. Give us a call now for our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID pandemic by the numbers. The State Department of Health Thursday says the number of new coronavirus infections has fallen across almost all of Northeast Florida. Another 214 cases were reported across the area, though, and the statewide total rose by just over 2,500. 7 new COVID-19 deaths reported in our area, 5 in Duval County and 1 each in Clay and Nassau counties. Now, we do need to note there were few people wearing masks or socially distancing last night at Cecil Airport as President Trump held a big rally there. Thousands of supporters gathered outside of a hangar at Cecil to hear the president speak. He gave an hour-long speech, and some of the highlights included criticizing his Democratic opponent, Joe Biden, for, he said, standing with socialists and communists. The president also praised Florida's Republican leaders, including Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry. Give us a call as we kick off the roundtable with a look back to this rally. By the way, it was held at the same time as the Jaguars were playing at home. They lost. 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Sky LeBron, let's begin with you. You attended the rally, spoke to some of the folks there. What were your initial reactions?
Well, there's a lot of excitement among a lot of people that were there. And that was the most immediate thing that I noticed is just the massive amount of people that were there. There is a line that was stretching down the block from where the hangar was, and it just kept on pouring in people for hours and hours, starting midday. And, you know, like you said in the beginning, there wasn't much social distancing. There weren't many masks. I didn't see many masks at all. And overall, when it got into the hangar and the speaking area, there was just thousands and thousands of people just waiting to hear the president speak. But overall, there was a lot of vibrancy and excitement for President Trump. He came in on Air Force One. It was a very dramatic entrance. And he gave a pretty vibrant speech as well that got his base very riled up.
It shows you the depths of the president's support in North Florida, Charles Griggs, and how important Jacksonville is both to the Trump campaign and also the Biden campaign. He held a virtual roundtable this week in Jacksonville with veterans. And looking at the images coming from the rally last night, it shows you the difference between these two candidates and how they're treating coronavirus. We have passed a milestone of 200,000 dead in this country from this disease. We do have a mask mandate in Duval County. However, it applies indoors strictly, less strictly outdoors. And that seems to be how the Trump campaign got around the mandate last night. Mayor Curry, who instituted the mandate himself, was at the rally last night without a mask.
Yeah, and it illustrates, you know, again, how the differences in ideology are coming across. You know, one candidate perceives a coronavirus as a deadly virus to Americans and how we should approach it to mitigate the negative outcomes because we have so many people who've died. Another candidate, the president, who feels like this is just a thing. You know, but as a campaign, really as an issue, coronavirus, the President Trump owns the coronavirus. This happened on his watch. And those 200,000 dead Americans that have been left in the wake so far are something that the American people, a lot of Americans are you know, trying to look for ways to hold them accountable about. And his rallies are one of those things that that we look for, that we, you know, we're pretty much used to with presidents. Most presidents enjoy a lot of popularity when they host rallies in various communities. I can remember when President Obama came to Jacksonville, out at the Jacksport a few years back. It was a tremendous crowd and people were excited and on and on. But that doesn't step away. That doesn't move away from the issues at hand. And you know, one of the things that we really need to be concerned about going forward is how we're going to continue to move with this virus. It is not over. People should not feel like this is something that's going to go away in the near future. It's going to be with us for a while. And no matter what people say regarding vaccines, this virus is going to have an impact in this country for the foreseeable future.
A.G. Gankarski, that's right. Although we have seen the COVID rates decline in our part of the state, which is very good news, there is worry that we will see a spike of this disease in the fall and winter. And we're getting lots of feedback on social media about the president's rally last night. Some people were really fired up. Others were concerned that this could be a COVID super spreader event.
Yeah, and that's always a speculation when you have 10,000 people, give or take, without masks during a pandemic. But, you know, really what's happening here is you've got two different approaches of branding this pandemic, and you see it with these campaigns. The Trump campaign is in overdrive, you know, drawing big events that are being described as vibrant, and he's, you know, getting hours of mic time, and Joe Biden is appearing on Zoom. Joe Biden, as Trump said last night, is calling lids at 9 o'clock in the morning so he doesn't have to answer questions about anything. And then he sends, you know, surrogates out to do Zoom drop-ins wherever else. And this is starting to make a mark. You're seeing the polling starting to move toward the president, and local polling's the same way. I'm hearing about internal polls that are showing Trump ahead of Biden. And if you saw the reaction last night, you would say, well, yeah.
Well, we spoke to the leading pollster in Jacksonville yesterday, Mike Bender of the Public Opinion Research Lab. I just want to jump in and say, to give a caveat to your remarks, he believes Joe Biden will win Duval County, but not necessarily the surrounding counties.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good caveat, but I'm just telling you what I'm seeing out here. And what's happening to Joe Biden is he's being depicted as weak. That's what's happening. Weak, diminished, unable to engage. And Donald Trump is out there, you know, basically saying that whatever happens to this pandemic, we're going to get through it. And you can say, yeah, there's 200,000 people dead. There's, you know, countless hundreds of thousands of medical bills they'll never dig out of, et cetera, et cetera. Not to mention the destruction of the economy. But what is happening here is people are perceiving that Donald Trump is more active in this campaign, and Joe Biden has no answer for it, and he doesn't really have time to recalibrate. Joe Biden's persona is what it is, and it's basically been frozen in place since the March primaries, when all the candidates basically bowed out so Biden could go unobstructed to the nomination to get rid of Bernie Sanders.
Let's talk about what the Biden campaign did in Florida this week. Dan Scanlon, as your organization, the Times Union, reported, he did hold a virtual roundtable with veterans in this community. Both of these candidates are going to be fighting hard for the veterans' vote, particularly here in this part of Florida. The recent revelations that the president referred to combat veterans as losers and suckers could erode his support among the military a little bit. According to some polls, that has happened. But it's still traditionally a Republican constituency. And so your thoughts about that?
Well, we are surrounded by Navy bases from Georgia into Jacksonville. The president spoke yesterday at a former Navy base that obviously there's some strong military in this area. The president has fought back with a recent ad talking about how he is supporting the military and a lot of impressive-looking images of him at various military events. And even last night, how impressive that whole scene was. If there was no coronavirus, Air Force One rolling into the background, The president speaking, surrounded by, at least TV is estimating, 15,000 people. One can't tell. I mean, I was at a funeral yesterday for a Clay County sergeant who passed away from COVID-19 complications, and I was surrounded by military. We had customs airplanes doing flyovers. If I'd said anything negative about Donald Trump yesterday, I probably would have been drummed out of the parking lot. So I think that shows what this area likes and wants. And yesterday, the president certainly reinforced that with his appearance and how dynamic everything was. Whereas Joe Biden, you're telling me he had a veterans speech on Zoom? That's a minor blip right now. I didn't even know about that in the crush of everything else I've been covering.
Sky.
Yeah, so I did want to talk about that veterans talk, that roundtable that he had. He actually wasn't in attendance for that, and I think that's something that is constantly associated with Joe Biden, is that he's been coming off as weak to some, and he hasn't been able to hold some of these events. For during that Jacksonville roundtable, it was a coordinator from the Joe Biden campaign that was talking to different veterans throughout Jacksonville. Those veterans were very much critical of the president and were talking about how, you know, they can't stand with somebody that would say those comments about people being suckers and losers for losing their life in war. And they also spoke about the Russian bounties that allegedly were set to the Taliban for U.S. soldiers. Those were two big topics that were brought up among Jacksonville veterans, but the vice president wasn't in attendance for that roundtable. It was primarily just a Biden campaigner.
Let's go to some calls for our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. Bob is in Ortega. Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you all for working today. And I would like to know if anyone knows if any of the Herman Cain family members attended the rally, or if the Hank Madden was a local family tea party, very strong, and he's gone now, too. I don't think he went to the rally. And then the president's brother, someone else close to the president. So all these people that are passing that would have voted for him, is that going to impact the election?
I detect a little sarcasm in your voice, Bob, about I don't believe the president's brother died of coronavirus, though, although you did reference Herman Cain. Here's a tweet from a listener. With all due respect, this isn't speculation. Trump rallies are super spreader events. Ask Herman Cain. Okay. Charles Greggs, you know, we have a lot of folks waiting on hold to weigh in on this, and I'll get to a few more calls in a moment. But I think this rally here in Jacksonville just sums up the divisions in this country right now. Whether you look at all of those people packed together in horror or with enthusiasm.
Yeah, Melissa, and another thing about the rally that was really concerning to some people I spoke with. In fact, I talked with some folks who are conservatives, and they, you know, they said to me basically, I don't understand why these rallies don't bother people because of the optics. Because this is not what America looks like. It sends the wrong message about how great we are as a country. It looks like it isn't a very diverse group of people. And I know that there are Republicans out there who support their ideology, but would rather for their party to appear to be more diverse in its showings. This is one of the things that that also continues to rally people on the other side and Democrats, along with situations like have gone on in Kentucky with the Breonna Taylor situation. You know, people are aware of the optics of what this looks like. And while Trump still has, he's very popular with his base, there are a lot of Americans out there that feel like this country has more to offer than to look like it is descending back into the 1940s and 50s.
Elliot is in Jack's Beach. Hi, Elliot. Go ahead.
Hello. I just I had to disagree respectfully about the rally and calling it a super spreader event, because it just seems like y'all choose to focus on things that you don't like to accentuate the negatives, and you ignore the things that you don't want to accentuate. You know, it's you know, you say 200,000 people have died, and you say it.
Oh, we lost
about
him.
The cause
go ahead.
Of all those. And you also, and I just have the feeling that if someone else was at the helm of this country, then the whole worst case scenario where they were saying 2 million people are going to die, 5 million people are going to die, what you'd be hearing is only 200,000 people have died instead of the 2 or 3 million that we thought. But instead of that, you hear 200,000 people have died. It's all on Trump. It's all on Trump. And that's just nonsense.
Elliot, thanks for the call. AG, 200,000 people are dead from the virus. It's the fourth largest mass casualty event in American history. It's an enormous death toll, and that we can't get around talking about that. I mean, that is undergirding this election, I think, more than any other issue. That said, we heard in Elliot's voice frustration with the way this is being covered.
Yeah, I mean, and Elliot's frustration, I think, is not to be ignored here, because if we take a historic look at how things are covered in this country, they are covered differently when Republicans do them versus Democrats. We didn't hear much about illegal wars during the Barack Obama administration, even though they were happening. The war on terror was expanding all over the place, but during the Bush era, we heard about it. And I think in this case, with COVID-19, because it's Donald Trump, because Donald Trump messages the way he does, because he's so provocative, he earns some of this coverage. He brings this on himself. He polarizes. But the effect of the polarization is there are a lot of people who agree with him, and a lot of people agree with Elliot. And, when people are analyzing elections, they tend to get aspirational. They tend to think this is how people should be. But what people are actually responding to is a feeling of safety, of so-called pocketbook issues, and they seem to want this right-of-center authoritarian vision. I don't know why that is, and maybe it will prove me wrong, but Joe Biden's got to do a lot better job messaging than he has, because he's losing this election, and there's a lot of Elliots out there.
Let me just add to that. Polling from your own outfit, AG, St. Pete Polls, shows Biden up by 3 in Florida. I think this election could go either way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a three-point lead that is dwindling. I mean, I've seen polling that show that 7 out of 8 people who are voting based on economic issues are voting for Donald Trump. And, what does Donald Trump have right now? He has the leverage of the federal government, new stimulus package, things like that could happen. And a lot of October surprises can happen that can swing that vote. Joe Biden doesn't have a lot of momentum right now. He's got a lot of money on TV. But money on TV isn't going to do it. Joe Biden's got to get out there and press the case in the way that he hasn't been able to prove that he's been able to do during this campaign.
Lots of calls. Let's go to Lynn on the South Side. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to weigh in on the comment that was made earlier about Joe Biden appearing weak. And, there are two sides here, as has been pointed out. I view Joe Biden and his way of handling this campaign as responsible, not weak. It's responsible. And, I know that my feelings are shared by many of the people that I know. Also, I wanted to weigh in on the rally last night. I was at the coffee shop this morning, and I was aware that some people were coming from out of state, but apparently there was quite a few people literally flown in by planes full from different areas. And I actually know some of the people that family members were flown in on military flight for the rally. So just because the optics are that there's this overwhelming support in Jacksonville, Florida for this president doesn't necessarily reflect everyone that's on the ground in this city. So anyway, thanks for letting me share that.
Thank you. Here are a couple of emails. Charlie emails the show, "I'm disgusted with the continuous spin from the media about how dynamic or vibrant the Trump rallies are. There is a pandemic going on, and Biden is doing the responsible thing and modeling proper behavior. It seems like the press gleefully presents Trump events as exciting when they could potentially kill Americans." Dan Scanlon, your final thoughts about this before we go on to some more news from the week.
Well, the one thing I noticed was watching the speech over the evening. The governor spoke. Almost no one in the stands behind him had a mask on. But I'm then told that the president and his people handed out Make America Great Again masks, and when the president spoke, I saw almost everybody behind him wearing them. So at what point is that a good idea? If you haven't worn a mask all night with thousands of people around you and then put on a mask, the the spreading has already begun. So that's my thought. It was a dynamic, impressive event, and I do agree with AG that that Mr. Biden needs to start doing some socially distanced public speaking to at least get on the ground and do a better job than his commercials.
It's 549-2937, our Friday roundtable with A.G. Gankarski, Dan Scanlon, Charles Griggs, Sky LeBron, and yours truly, as we talk about the biggest news of the week. We're going to move on now and touch on some other news and notes from the last several days. Potentially millions of ballots will be hitting the mail in your mailbox for the November 3rd general election in Florida. Look out for them. County supervisors of elections are required to send out their first big batches of vote-by-mail ballots starting yesterday and going through October 1st. In Duval County, Supervisor of Elections Mike Hogan is warning voters to make sure your ballot is counted, to fill it out correctly, mail it back correctly in the proper envelope. Charles Griggs, there is just an enormous amount of anxiety about mail-in ballots. And we need to stress this, and we'll keep stressing it as we get closer to the election. We very likely won't have a result on election night. We may have an election week in this country. Both campaigns have lawyered up. There's quite a bit of alarm about how this is going to play out. I think that alarm increased the other day when the president told a reporter in the White House briefing room that he wouldn't necessarily accept a peaceful transition of power should he lose the election. Voters on both sides are on edge. And, you know, the supervisors of elections around Florida, like Mike Hogan, they have a big job ahead of them.
Well, I was going to mention this during the, when we were talking about the rallies. The rallies are, you know, those are show tunes, basically. But this election is going to be won in the courtroom. We've been warned. We know that this is going to be highly controversial. The fact that we're even have to push mail-in ballots to, you know, for folks to get their ballots in, to be able to feel safe voting is something that's of major concern. You know, gone are the days when you could just walk up to a polling site and feel safe and comfortable about being able to vote for fear of being rejected for whatever reason. And to be honest, I don't know why people feel comfortable with the vote by mail piece. There's as much opportunity to get that wrong as it is to get them wrong at the polling site. So this is going to make 2001 look like a Pop Warner football game. This thing is going to come down to the lawyers, the courtrooms, probably all the way up to the Supreme Court, dealing with how this election turns out. Unless there's a landslide one way or the other, I can't see how all of these states, all of the electoral votes are contested in some kind of way related to this presidential election.
We do need to be prepared for that. Sky LeBron, in Duval County, early voting begins October 19th, Monday, October 19th. We have 2 weeks of early voting here before the election. It's a shorter window than a lot of other places. We see on national news, people around the country lining up now to vote in a number of states. The election has actually already begun.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, that would be my suggestion, to try to vote as soon as possible so that you don't have to worry about going into big events and on election day having to deal with maybe hundreds of people. As much as they will try to social distance and implement these different measures, one thing I wanted to say specifically to Duval County is that they recently got a bill that would allow them to spend more money on social distancing measures. I believe it's around $1 million. And so based on somebody I was talking to from the Supervisor of Elections office, that would allow them to hire more poll workers, get more PPE, and get more technology so that things are more spread out, so that people are able to vote without having to interact with as little amount of people as possible. So we are seeing a lot of these polling locations across the state, because this was a bill that was across the entire state that would allow more safety measures for early voting and eventually on November's election day, too.
Yeah, and AG, in the past, over the last 20-plus years, the Republican Party in Florida has really perfected the practice of turning out Republican voters who liked to vote by mail. This year, it's sort of a flip. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, we're seeing more Democrats requesting mail-in ballots, and we're expecting more Republicans to vote in person. That has sort of upended the dynamics of get out the vote for both parties here in Florida.
Yeah, but I would caution against assuming that even the majority of Democrats are going to vote by mail. I mean, this is going to be an election where there's going to have to be some sort of traditional operation, because I think you're going to see about two-thirds of people in the end voting in person, whether in early voting or on election day. So the door knocking, these kind of things that haven't happened on the left need to start happening, because, you know, counting on harvesting the mail ballots, you know, that's great, but that's just one strategy. It's not a comprehensive strategy. And an election that's going to be as close as it is here and in the state, it's going to be these things that make the difference between winning and losing.
It's 549-2937 as we talk about mail-in ballots and voting. The election is November 3rd, but mail-in ballots are going out now. In Duval County alone, the Supervisor of Elections Office has sent out about 264,000 mailers to households, encouraging people to vote by mail. Give us a call and let us know, what is your plan to vote? Do you plan to vote by mail? Do you plan to vote in person? Do you plan to vote early? Or do you plan to vote on election day? We want to hear from you. Let's go to Lori in San Marco. I know you're still getting Lori into the queue, but hey, Lori. Hey, Lori, you're on the air. Go ahead, Lori.
Hi, Melissa. So I just wanted to bring my perspective. For years, I worked for a voter registration company, probably the biggest one in America. And what I'm surprised people aren't talking about is the integrity of the voter registration rolls, because perpetrating voter fraud on a huge level is hard to do, because you have to, it's not like people just send their vote in and everything gets counted. Every voter has a verification process that has meticulously gone through over software. So really the weakness is if someone was out registering a bunch of fake people, well, that could swing an election. But as far as the number of mistakes in the voter rolls, there's not that many. And so I feel like this is a distraction. I think the integrity of the voter rolls in general is good, and there's not going to be enough mistakes in it to where we're going to see an election taken over by fraud.
Lori, thanks for that. You know, Dan Scanlon, we need to talk a little bit about this, because there's been so much fear and cynicism about the integrity of the ballots. And this state has been voting by mail for quite some time. And they do have a procedure in place for making sure that your ballot gets received and counted. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, if you go to DuvalElections.com, one of the options you've got there is to check the status of your mail ballot. If there's any problems, you can check it right there. You can request a mail-in ballot for the general election as late as October 24th. That's still scary to me that just with the way the mail is working, that it may not get there in time. And don't forget that this week a large number on Tuesday of local pastors protested in front of Mike Hogan's supervisor office, demanding that he mail every voter a mail ballot application, install drop boxes to collect mail ballots, and make sure that Edward Waters College and UNF are early voting sites, such as they were in 2018. But they're not this time around, Hogan saying, but apparently they just didn't have a lot of people there. So Prime Osborne and Florida State College, Deerwood Center, are going to be some mass voting sites.
Thank you for that. Yvonne in Jacksonville. Hi, Yvonne. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Basically, I was calling because there's been several states, and the tone was set very early on with fraud in mail-in ballots. And there's several states that have been voting for over 10 years very successfully with mail-in ballots, where you drive up and drop your ballot in the mail. And so I really don't understand why everybody is in a tailspin over this. Here in Florida, we've had very successful mail-in ballots, especially when you're not in town, as well as going in. And there's how many states are there actually that have been doing mail-in ballot for the last 10 years that don't have any of the problems that we have with taking it in? And so the tone was set very, very early on. And unfortunately, I think with the media and everybody have taken it to a new level without really saying, we've had successful mail-in ballots for over 2 years in these various states. Why are we having a problem now?
Yvonne, thanks. Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. We have tried to communicate that as well on this program. Jane in Ponte Vedra. Go ahead, Jane.
Hi. I think that the discussion about mail-in voting and so forth is a distraction from what was discovered in the Russian investigation with the DNI when Dan Coats was investigating the malware that was discovered in Florida's election system in St. Lucie County and Washington County was never enacted, but it was available if someone wanted to, for example, delete every 10th voter or change the totals with regard to counties that were in the minority. I just read this in the book Rage, and I believe that all the discussion about mail-in and fraud is just a distraction from the fact that something is going on behind the scenes with the Russian investigation that's never been fully discussed in 2016.
Jane, thanks. Bob Woodward's best-selling book, Rage, did talk about Washington and St. Lucie counties and how Russian malware did penetrate their election systems in 2016. We do not have proof that any votes were changed. However, we do not have proof that Russian malware is having any impact on our current election. I did interview the statewide supervisor of elections a few weeks ago. His name is Craig Latimer, and I did press him on these questions repeatedly since listeners like you have brought them up to us so often. And the supervisors around Florida are adamant that their election systems are secure, and that is what we have been able to report. That said, I think your comments reflect the anxiety many voters feel about this election overall, and that is certainly one of the issues that is lending itself to this anxiety. Now, all of that said, we're going to move on and talk about some other news. The Jacksonville City Council on Tuesday shot down a plan that would have frozen nearly half of the police budget for this county. It's $484 million and would have required Sheriff Williams to appear before the council in 6 months to get the remaining portion of his budget. Councilman Garrett Dennis tried to pass this plan on the same night the council approved the city's budget, but he withdrew it after encountering opposition by his colleagues, even those who advocate overall police reform. Okay, AG Gankarski, Dennis really stood alone on this. There are a number of activists really applying pressure now in Jacksonville and in cities across America to reallocate police budgets, which they say are bloated, to more to social service crime prevention programs, I think is the umbrella term I'm looking for here. But that was a tough sell before this city council.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, it was ultimately a performative discussion because there's no pathway for the Dennis proposal. It gave Garrett Dennis and Lenny Curry opportunities to posture. You know, Garrett Dennis got to come out and say that he had a plan, even though he had no political consensus behind that plan. And he got, you know, discussion that at some point down the road, this council is going to rectify some of the longstanding social issues. And Lenny Curry, of course, he is the big winner of this because he's gotten the posture that liberals are trying to cut the sheriff's office budget, and that he stopped it, and that 70% of voters support the sheriff's budget being as it is, and he's with the 70% and so on. And, you know, let's be honest, I mean, Lenny Curry needs some political wins, and Garrett Dennis gave him one. But you know, given the legacy costs of the JSO, given, you know, the fact that it's not all just paying for cops and bullets, but there's all kinds of other things there, the proposal wasn't really rooted in reality. The idea that Sheriff's Office is going to come back in 6 months and lobby, sing for its supper, I don't know how that they were going to get 10 votes out of that, because all these guys need a police union's endorsement to run for anything.
Charles Griggs. Dennis got this before the council because they were treated to hours of public comment from activists who are pushing what they call the people's budget. They want to reduce the sheriff's budget to 20% of the total Jack City budget and reinvest that money into community-oriented initiatives like mental health treatment centers, infrastructure, education. They are arguing that that would have a better impact on preventing crime and pointing out that The crime rate in this city has remained high for many years, despite the robust funding of law enforcement. And so, in your thoughts, how does this argument progress in the city of Jacksonville?
Well, it became fairly obvious that as the bill was introduced, that Garrett Dennis didn't really believe that this would pass. But what the intent was really to shake up the conversation about how Jacksonville spends its money on trying to solve its problems. Really, I think what the people from the public, the folks who submitted the people's budget, and other folks around the community were trying to do is say there needs to be a conversation about how the city, implements its budget. We know that process, it happens, it occurs. Traditionally, the administration presents a budget in July. It gets reviewed by this newly seated finance committee in August, and then they approve it in September. Not really a whole lot of time for the general public to be heard on how this budget is put together and what their ideas are related to how problems can be solved. And what we end up with is the status quo. So at least Councilman Dennis was able to get a commitment out of President Hazzouri to further look at this issue, and perhaps some conversations with the public can be had in order to look at how to do things differently and find ways to innovate, because we do have record-pacing murder rate here in Duval County, and the inability to innovate beyond the rhetoric is what's challenging our community.
Sky LeBron, this whole conversation came up a day after Governor DeSantis introduced legislation that would crack down on social justice protesters and even punish communities that reduce spending on their police departments. He would strip away federal and state grants. So this discussion happened in the context of that move by the governor.
Yeah, and Mayor Curry, he spoke at the rally yesterday, and he spoke briefly on that as well, how I think the whole defund the police is really turned into a huge trigger word that Republicans are able to use. And when Garrett Dennis, he brought it up in a smaller public meeting prior to bringing it up the day of the budget, the final budget approval. And he said multiple times, this isn't defunding the police. This is just about more accountability and oversight and some transparency. But Mayor Curry and a couple of the council members, when they were speaking about Dennis's bill, they called it defunding the police. They called it disrespectful and an attack on law enforcement. I thought there was one interesting perspective. I listened to the whole city council meeting that night, and Randy DeFore, I thought, had a really interesting perspective where she said, you know, I'm not with you. I come from a family of law enforcement, but I think the fact that you brought this up really says something and says that we need to have a conversation moving forward, even if I don't agree with you.
Now, speaking of law enforcement, Dan Scanlon at Fletcher High School, a flag that was meant to memorialize police officers has been banned. A football player at Fletcher High memorialized his father at every game by carrying a police remembrance flag onto the field. School officials say he cannot do that anymore because it has become a political statement that doesn't represent the team or the school. It was a thin blue line flag. And so as the schools are dealing with how to educate kids safely in this pandemic, these types of issues are also flaring up in the local school system.
Well, I couldn't help but notice, but yesterday, what is said to be the largest Blue Lives Matter flag in the country was hanging at the entrance to Sergeant Eric Twisdale's funeral at the church. And a number of people commented on the fact that that flag was not allowed at a school. NFL players are wearing a lot of messages on their helmets these days. And there's the president himself saying it's time to start teaching a more patriotic mode of education in schools. So there's a big amount of mixed messages out there. The heroes of our teams, the football players, are protesting. Police, including a firefighter in my neighborhood, have been flying or want to fly those Blue Lives Matter flags. And certainly there's been some reason for that with recent numbers of cops being shot and killed. But yet you can't talk about that as just a piece of history and current events.
AG, the principal of Fletcher High School sent a statement about this, saying that there needs to be an appropriate way of expressing personal views and that they need to maintain the school's role as a venue for constructive dialogue and not a proponent of any particular point of view.
Yeah, that's one take on it. I think the whole controversy, it illustrates, as if any more illustration was needed, that, you know, all these issues are polarization across demographics, across generations, and, you know, that's why they don't lend themselves to easy categorization. A lot of people on the right are holding up the story right now about the Blue Lives Matter flag as totemic, and expect that to continue getting national media play. But in terms of, you know, how Fletcher handles it, it's just like any other high school principal, basically hand-wringing till it goes away.
Mm. And, you know, Charles Griggs, in the context of this whole dust-up at Fletcher, I want to just note also that this week we've heard a lot from parents about the other big issue that the school system is dealing with, and that's obviously coronavirus. Parents across the state are pressing the Department of Education and school districts pretty hard for more transparency about the number of positive COVID cases in their child's school.
Yeah, and the districts are really operating on a delicate balance based upon what the Department of Education is recommending and telling them what they need to do. So while the local districts are, you know, trying their best to protect the students that are put in awkward situations, students and parents, as well as the staff in awkward situations related to social distancing, you know, how to create these learning environments where the kids can grow and have great outcomes and stay as close to an environment which they are used to having prior to COVID-19. You know, a lot of the issues for how they should govern themselves are still wavy. You know, they're just not solid. The information they're getting from the top is keeping them from being, you know, creating a system where they have checks and balances that won't change on a daily basis. And so they have to stay nimble. It's going to be frustrating. It's frustrating to parents. It's frustrating to administrations. It's frustrating to teachers as well. I know, because I have a grandson in the public school system right now. I know everyone's doing, you know, their best to make sure that students stay protected. But, you know, I see both sides where, you know, parents who don't feel safe sending their students to school and they want to keep them home virtually. But it's, the rules are changing almost every day from the top all the way down to the district level, to the classroom.
I do want to give kudos to the Duval County leadership. They have been publishing a dashboard that I check regularly for my children showing COVID cases in each school. So wanted to mention that quickly as well. And I want to thank all of you, Charles Griggs, A.G. Gankarski, Dan Scanlon, and Sky LeBron, offering great insights on this show. Always appreciate your participation, guys. Thank you so much, and have a great weekend.
You too, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. And in a moment, echoes of the Gilded Age now going up on the walls of the Leitner Museum in St. Augustine. We'll speak to the muralist creating this work next.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross addresses issues important to our Northeast Florida communities. Our firm is pleased to support WJCT's First Coast Connect.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Pink Ribbon Symposium, Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center, and WJCT present a virtual workshop on the latest advancements in breast cancer and leading healthy lifestyles, Saturday, October 10th at 9 a.m. Event is free, but registration is required at WJCT.org.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Max Mayfield, former director of the National Hurricane Center. This hurricane season, you need to update your family preparedness plan so it includes COVID-19 preparations. So when a storm threatens, be ready to prepare your home and have your family hurricane kit ready. It includes supplies for your pets and enough COVID-19 sanitizers, disinfectant wipes, and masks. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorm.org.
Millions of Americans lack health insurance, but even those who have it can get into big financial trouble with medical bills.
The person's like, if you pay double the payment this month, we won't sue you. And so I'm like, I can't do that. Then they're like, we'll sue you. And I'm like, well, then I'm going to file bankruptcy and you're not getting nothing.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, the Bill of the Month. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
The country remembers a champion of justice. Breonna Taylor's family say they're denied theirs. And wait, what?
Get rid of the ballots and you'll have a very peaceful, there won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation.
Alarm grows as the president won't commit to a peaceful transition of power. It's going to be a busy Friday news roundup next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. First Coast artist Joshua Cooper was recently chosen to paint a new mural analyzing the Gilded Age. This will be mounted at the Leitner Museum in St. Augustine. And his work will be permanently displayed among some of the historic treasures of the nation's oldest city. There are parallels to the actual Gilded Age of some 100 years ago and this period of economic inequality we are living in now. I spoke with Cooper about the mural and its message.
Hi, Joshua. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So a new mural at the Leitner Museum. You were chosen to display your talents. What will visitors to the museum see?
So I'm doing three portraits of Gibson girls. They were from the early 20th century.
Right.
And I'm painting
with
them.
The big yeah. Hair. They had a really distinctive look. Yeah.
Yeah, they were kind of considered the first standards of beauty in America. They were created by Charles Gibson in the late 1800s, and they caught on in 1901 to 1910 during the Edwardian period.
What made you choose that?
So I was inspired by some of the items I've seen around the Leitner Museum. They're based on items from around the Gilded Age, and they wanted something that really was inspired by the Gilded Age, inspired by music, because I'm painting in the music room. So I thought I would show these Gibson girls as the Greek muses, who are the inspiration for all of the arts.
That sounds interesting. And this will be 188 square feet. You did a mural at the Jacksonville Zoo that was even bigger than that. But what's it like to do a large-scale piece like this? What are some of the challenges that go into that?
It is challenging. So you have to start with a small study. But even then, you're not really sure what you're going to get into when you go into the bigger piece. But it also leaves a lot of room for experimentation. So it's always fun because no one painting is like the last painting, and the big paintings are the most fun.
You know, it's interesting, the theme here. Let's talk about that. The Leitner Museum, of course, used to be a hotel, the Alcazar Hotel. It was built by Henry Flagler, and it has an amazing collection of fine and decorative art. It's really worth a visit. And so the museum ran this contest asking artists to submit ideas that reflect the history of the Leitner and also the Gilded Age. And
yeah.
So echoes of the Gilded Age, which was about 100 years ago, are being reflected, historians say, in our current time that we're living in. So how do you see your challenge to do this painting of in the style of the Gibson girls sort of reflecting that?
Well, I've been heavily inspired by artists such as John Singer Sargent, which, if you look at his portraits, are heavily inspired by the Gilded Age and Gilded Age luxury. But behind that, there's obviously a lot more struggles that are going on. And I'm trying to highlight what we think about of that era when we're thinking about the Gilded Age.
Have you started painting yet?
I have. So I've worked on three figures. I have gotten the portraits done, and I'm close to getting worked on the background and painting the rest of their bodies.
And this will be unveiled when? Pretty soon, huh?
Pretty soon. I'll be done on October 10th, and it'll be open during their reopening.
Which we're looking forward to, along with so many other cultural institutions around the area. So this is exciting, and thank you for telling us about it. Artist Joshua Cooper chosen to paint a new mural inside the Leitner Museum reflecting a Gilded Age theme. We look forward to seeing this. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And a quick note, coming up this weekend, the Void Pro-Am 2020 Surf Contest presented by Kona Brewing Company will be taking place at the Jacks Beach Pier. Now, this is a community-focused surfing contest. It'll feature both professional and amateur divisions, including Grom Divisions 2. Come on out and witness this area's top surfing talent while they battle it out for bragging rights and a chance to win some cold, hard cash in the men's and women's pro divisions. This is a lot of fun, a great end-of-summer event, the Jacks Beach Pier Void Pro-Am 2020 Surf Contest presented by Kona Brewing Company. More on this at voidlive.com, one of our media partners. Have fun, everybody. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital director. Keep that feedback coming. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to tune into the Florida Roundup today at noon, our live statewide call-in program, where we round up the biggest stories from across Florida this week. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.